Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced by Dynamics Productions with the support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin, and thanks for joining us. Leaders of the nonprofit Brookings Institution, one of the nation's most influential think tanks, have said repeatedly that public investment in rural areas doesn't deliver a good return on investment. Brian Dabson does not agree with that assessment. Now a research fellow at the University of North Carolina School of Government, Dabson is former director of the Institute for Public Policy at the University of Missouri and has led the Rural Policy Research Institute, as well as the Corporation for Enterprise Development, and he joins us from Charlotte. Greetings, Brian.
Greetings. Thank you, Tom.
So some very powerful influencers, the Brookings Institution and the New York Times, to cite a couple, have for more than a decade now argued that the government is spending massive amounts of money on rural America that they say is misdirected or misused and ought to be directing that money to big cities. So tell us why you don't accept that rural investment is ineffective.
Well, one of the first things that I object to in that particular stance from Brookings and the New York Times is that we're in some sort of zero-sum game, is that to invest in rural automatically means you invest less in the cities. But much more than that is this belief that only cities offer prospects for prosperity, innovation, growth, and that rural America basically has had its day. There's a number of things which we can unpack, that investment in agriculture, which is where most of the money, which is labeled rural America, goes to, though just keeping farmers happy through subsidies is not having much benefit for people who live and work in rural America who are not on the farm. So we get this discussion about, well, all this money going into supporting farmers, surely that should have benefited everybody else in rural America. And isn't it time, actually, we stop providing that sort of support when we've got urgent needs for innovation and growth in the cities? And my argument basically is that is one that rural and urban America are interdependent. We need each other for the future prosperity of the country as a whole. Rural America is where food comes from, where energy, the management and stewardship of our natural resources, a whole raft of things for which the country as a whole needs people in rural America to be paying attention, to be husbanding those resources, and generally staying on the land or in rural communities to be able to keep everything going. We undervalue the work that's done in rural America, and we don't invest in the things that are essential to keep communities together in rural America, whether that's in education or healthcare or broadband or infrastructure. We've been happy to extract all the resources from rural America, but we've not been prepared to invest in keeping people there to look after all those resources on our behalf.
Brian, what we see in Appalachian Kentucky is that two of those items that you just mentioned, infrastructure and broadband, yes, access to the internet, robust access to the internet, and consistent robust access, are the two major impediments to getting to the other side of this situation. Would you agree with that assessment?
Yes, I mean the broadband is part of essential infrastructure, just like electricity and water. It doesn't guarantee economic success, but without them, you will not get any form of economic success. Yes, there are a whole bunch of impediments, but places like Central Appalachia have suffered from long-term disinvestment. They've had extraction mentality, sucking out all the resources, land owned by people not in the local area. and the lack of investment in all the other things that are important in education and workforce development and the like, and healthcare. All those things over many, many years have left those areas with very little to go on and upon which to build a new future for themselves.
We hear from many working in economic development, for example, in Appalachian Kentucky, that the region's economic salvation is really a do-it-yourself prospect, that it's become futile for some time now to look to Washington, to state government, to the private sector to come to the rescue. What do you think of that?
It's part right. I think that asset-based development with the do-it-yourself approach that you've described, I think is really an important part of the equation. But everywhere needs external resources and investment, whether it's from the Fed, the state, the federal government, the states, or private sector philanthropy, in order to achieve everything they want. But you can't just sit there and wait for these resources to come to you. Nobody's going to come on a white horse these days and save you. But I think in order to attract any resources into your community or into your region, you've got to have the vision, you've got to have the good ideas and the strategies to make things happen. All you need is the support. So I don't think you can go it alone entirely, but you certainly do need to have a vision and some good ideas as to where you'd like to go so that people feel that there's something that's worth investing in.
The Appalachian Regional Commission just released its annual ranking of the economic status of each of the region's counties, 420 of them. And it's accompanied by this color-coded map. And when you stand back and look at that, it looks like there's this big red bullseye of distress plastered all over central Appalachia. And the report indicates that for 18 of these counties, it's going to get worse in the coming fiscal year. So given what you just said, how does this region overcome such a negative perception and it actually attract meaningful investment?
I wish I had a good answer. You know, the Appalachian Regional Commission has been in business for 50 years, investing in up and down the mountain chain in a whole variety of things. And the stubborn situation in the core of Appalachia and central Appalachia has not moved all that much. Part of the problem, and it doesn't just apply to central Appalachia, but to a large raft of rural America, is you've got all these counties and local governments which are dreadfully under-resourced. They don't have the capacity to respond to local needs. And I suspect that what you need is some really good regional investment focused on some of these areas, really trying hard to look for assets upon which they can base a new future. But you've really got to engage the locals and get them to see that there's hope in their communities for the future. I wouldn't want to say, although I think it has to be on the table, is that not every community can survive. If their original future was solely in coal mining and what have you, and the coal mines are shut, the question is, can there actually be an alternative rationale for those communities? And it may be that in one or two cases, there is no rationale, and one needs to think about how you can sort of manage the decline. But that's not for all those counties, and I'm pretty darn sure that there are counties there with a bit of careful strategizing and investment could offer a better set of opportunities for their residents.
You know, we were talking earlier about the concentration of population in urban areas. We're beginning to hear of some trending in the opposite direction, particularly among young professionals, millennials, who are beginning to look at rural areas as an alternative to the difficulties and challenges and unaffordability of urban life. Of course, the other side of that equation has to come from the communities that want to attract them. And I think that's what you're getting at there in part, is it?
In part, certainly. The people who are talking about moving from the cities to the rural areas may well have had some connection in the past. Maybe they have grandparents who used to live in those areas. They have some rosy-eyed view about what it would take to live in the country. But they still are looking for some really basic things which they expect to have anywhere, and that a good school system, a good health system, effective broadband, good communication. So there has to be that in place for those millennials to go back. Even if they want to return to the land, there's certain minimum expectations. On the other hand, communities which have been basically closed for a long time have got to change their perspectives on newcomers and be much more welcoming. If they're going to put a fence around themselves and say, we're not interested in these people because they don't think the way we do, then you're just closing the door to a better economic future. They've got to figure out ways of welcoming newcomers, people who are bringing new ideas, new investments into their communities. And in beautiful places like much of central Appalachia, which are not that far from major centers, major cities, it's an intriguing prospect that some of these really struggling communities could offer a whole new lifestyle packaged around meeting their essential goals for a different lifestyle, but working with communities to make them that much more welcoming.
Well, Brian, I've read that you are a proponent of community development financial institutions, CDFIs as they're called. What do you see in them? And is this where investment capital might enjoy a return?
I'm a fan of regional development organizations generally. CDFIs are one form of that. CDFIs, as you will know, are regional mechanisms which attract capital in ways that can be then reinvested in businesses and entrepreneurs in their local area. They're the connectors, if you like, understanding the needs of local communities and their businesses and the particular characteristics, and connecting them to sources of capital which are drawn from outside. It's a bridging function which doesn't happen in many other ways. Other forms of regional development organizations like councils of government or economic development districts, where several counties and small cities can work together to jointly plan, jointly office basic public services to their residents, are another example. So these small communities don't have the resources or the technical capacity, the strength to be able to meet all the needs that our local communities have. But if they could work together across jurisdictions, across boundaries, in groups, whether through CDFIs, through regional development organizations, they have so much better chance of being able to achieve some of their objectives they have for their local areas. But you know, if you don't have any resources to plan, to bring people together, to vision, to imagine what a new future will be like, then unfortunately you're just going to sit and watch it decline still further. And I think these regional organizations are a really good way to go.
We have just about 90 seconds left, and what I'm about to ask you might be a little bit redundant, given what you just said. But if I were to ask you to devise a checklist that these rural communities might follow to attract investment, what would be on it?
Demonstrated leadership and commitment from within the community to change and to grasp new opportunities would be number one. A willingness to collaborate and work together with neighboring communities and to pull resources in, and then to make sure that the basics are in place, that you've got good infrastructure, that you've got broadband access, that you're doing something about education and healthcare. And even if there's been rationalization of health and education in your area, try and figure out, using remote technologies, ways of bringing back school facilities, further education facilities, and clinics into your community. Because all those are requirements which everybody needs, irrespective of whether they live in a rural or urban area.
Brian Dabson is a research fellow at the University of North Carolina School of Government. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Tom.
Meanwhile, a new report from Brookings warns that coal-dependent communities are at risk of fiscal collapse if they don't find ways to replace lost tax revenue as the mining industry declines. The authors say policies to address climate change would accelerate the decline, but could also provide a new stream of revenue. Sydney Bowles has more.
The report found that policies to address climate change would increase the risk of fiscal collapse in counties that are significantly tied to coal. Unless, that is, those climate change policies included specific means to support coal-reliant communities and displaced miners. Adele Morris is a senior fellow and policy director at the Brookings Institution, and she's one of the report's co-authors. She says policies like taxing carbon emissions or regulating greenhouse gases would mean a rapid decline in coal production, and that would have far-reaching consequences.
You've got the workers who are dislocated. You have the loss of property tax and sales tax revenues. People are closing schools and limiting other government services. And then what happens is people move away.
But Morris says all of this is already happening, even without significant climate change prevention policies. In West Virginia, for example, Boone County saw total revenues drop by more than a third in just 5 years because of the decline in tax revenue from coal. So whether or not there are new climate change policies, Morris says, county governments need to plan for a transition or risk defaulting on loans and bond payments and potentially even bankruptcy. Morris has existing ideas to prioritize coal communities, like the Reclaim Act, might not be enough.
Those are kind of small potatoes compared with what's really necessary. We really need something in the billions of dollars per year invested in these communities.
The study shows that climate change policies, combined with major investments in coal communities, could help the region achieve an economic shift while preventing further damage to the climate. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Sydney Bowles.
Coming up after the break, there's a lot that has to happen before the more distressed counties of eastern Kentucky can hope to attract investments that jumpstart local economies. Lend the belief that it can't hurt to look at other places facing the same challenges and how they're beginning to turn the tide, we check in with Tim Marama, he's the editor of the Daily Yonder, about his recent reporting on Grundy County, Tennessee.
They're dealing with a lot of the same economic and social conditions that come from difficulties in extractive industries like oil and gas and coal and timber, the kinds of things that we traditionally have depended on in eastern Kentucky as sort of a mainstay of our economy. So I think there's a lot of parallels, and I was struck by how similar these communities were with what I'm familiar with in eastern Kentucky.
Later in the hour, a peek into the Google toolbox. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It could be used in a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or other past episodes? You can find them online at weku.fm or the WEKU mobile app. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Tim Marama joins us from Knoxville, where he slays over a hot computer as editor of the Daily Yonder, which has been published online for a dozen years now by the Center for Rural Strategies, a nonprofit media organization based in Knoxville and Whitesburg. Now, I wanted to talk with Tim about an article that he published back in March under the headline, "A Healthy Attitude, Rural Leaders in Tennessee County Organized to Address Well-Being." It's extensive, and I recommend reading it in full. You'll find a link under the Facts and Information tab on our site, esweku.com. I thought we might learn a thing or two about improving community health by asking Tim for an overview of his observations. So thanks for joining us, Tim.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you.
And first, I'm curious, what attracted you in the first place as a reporter to cover what's going on in Grundy County, Tennessee?
Well, as so often is the case, it started with a phone call. These days, maybe an email, but a social work professor at Middle Tennessee State University who had worked down in Grundy County in behavioral health called me and said, you've got to see what's happening in this county with their work on community health. And she put me in touch with Emily Parton, who is from Grundy and had moved off and come back. And she was the kind of person you just, she's not somebody you say no to. So I wound up going down to visit after talking to Emily.
That term well-being is a big one. It can cover a lot of things. What in this case, what issues are being considered?
The story is based around the rankings of Grundy County in a national study done annually by Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, a health funder, and University of Wisconsin called the County Health Rankings. And they look at various factors, not just sickness or wellness or incidence of disease, but things like the economic activity that's going in a county, how long people drive to get to work, how well they're doing in education, lots and lots of different factors that if you were looking at your own family and saying, how well are we doing? Are we healthy? These are the kinds of things you would say, yeah, my kids are doing well in school. There's opportunity. We've got access to a doctor. I've got a job. My church is active, you know, those kinds of things. So this well-being index that they've developed is very inclusive and gets way beyond the idea of just strictly, am I technically healthy or not?
Well, conditions in Grundy County, Tennessee could easily describe life in any number of eastern Kentucky counties. In your view, should county leaders in eastern Kentucky look to Grundy as a model?
I grew up in eastern Kentucky, and I found just remarkable parallels. Grundy County had a railroad going into it for coal before the Civil War. So most of eastern Kentucky would have been, what, around the 1900s or later. So this was a very early part of the coal economy and the Industrial Revolution. So they're kind of a generation or two ahead of where we were in eastern Kentucky. They got a railroad up there early on, and so we're able to haul coal out. And the similarities continue in terms of sort of development patterns. It's very rural. The economy in coal busted there about in mid-1980s, say, so a little bit ahead of much of eastern Kentucky. And so they're dealing with a lot of the same economic and social conditions that come from difficulties in extractive industries like oil and gas and coal and timber, the kinds of things that we traditionally have depended on in eastern Kentucky as sort of a mainstay of our economy. So I think there's a lot of parallels, and I was struck by how similar these communities were with what I'm familiar with in eastern Kentucky.
Well, as I understand it from your article, they now have managed to lift themselves up off of the bottom of that ranking. Where have they been seeing success so far?
Well, they've rocketed from 95th last place to 93. And I'm grinning, as you can hear. And I think that where they would, the response in Grundy County literally was, you know, we don't want to get better at the expense of someone else. They didn't wish last place on anybody. So that wasn't their goal with what they were doing. They wanted to lift their community's well-being index relative to where they were. And the things that they're measuring are very long term. You don't turn around your high school graduation rate overnight. You don't turn around the number of jobs in a community or these kind of long term endemic measurements. So I would look kind of long term, and that's what really attracted me to the county, were the way they had kind of dug in around some programs that are not going to jimmy the figures to make them look better. But in my estimation, were things that were about long-term change.
We often hear it said here on Eastern Standard. In fact, Tad Long of the Kentucky League of Cities recently said it. The cavalry isn't coming, we're it. In other words, if we want to improve things, we need to stop waiting for somebody else to come in and do it. And in fact, there is a lot of that initiative going on in the region. You describe how Grundy County has kind of picked up on that ethic as well. Can you tell us more?
Yes. To me, what seemed to be happening was there was a really good mix of long-established, rooted families and people involved, you know, community institutions, churches, schools, well-rooted families, combined with some anchor institutions that had been there for a long time, such as University of the South in Suwanee, which is just to the south of Grundy County, and up on the, they're on a ridge above Chattanooga, about an hour outside of Chattanooga. It's about 1,000 feet up, which will sound familiar to Eastern Kentuckians. And they say, if you're going to work off the plateau there, you're going off the mountain. And so this was a big impediment to economic exchange between the Tennessee Valley and the Cumberland Plateau. So Suwanee was up there on top of the ridge, which was important. There were people who had moved into the region very early on when the railroad first came in for second homes to escape the heat in the summertime before the turn of the 20th century. So there were some kind of external resources that were there. But then the way when things started to take off, in my estimation, was when those external resources began to ask the local community, okay, what do you need? What's going to work here? Instead of saying, here's a program to teach your kids how to read, take it or leave it. It was more like, we can bring these resources, you tell us what would be most effective. So they created a community foundation, which they were unserved by a community foundation. And there's a parallel with the community foundation for Appalachian Kentucky. There was Suwanee, which kind of had a history of a little bit touchy with the local community until a vice chancellor came in who was very much driven by this, tell us what you need and we'll help you get it philosophy. So there was that anchor institution. There were nonprofits like Tennessee Volunteer Behavioral Health, the school system, Family Resource Center, and the professor from MTSU that I spoke about. And it seemed to be this kind of confluence of external resources and people combined with very locally driven ideas and programs, and matching the two seems to be where the impact, they're kind of gearing up for the long haul, it feels like.
You note in your article that these programs have grown from local leadership, people like Emily Parton, who you mentioned earlier. Would you say that success or failure really turns on whether you have that kind of leadership in your community?
I think it's one of the ingredients. I mean, my own experience as someone who's lived in small communities, economically challenged communities, that certainly local leadership is key, leadership that people trust and know. And, you know, that can kind of cut both ways. It could be the old guard that just kind of does the same thing over and over and over again, and it never changes, but people know who they are, versus someone who comes in with all new ideas and no connection to the community and says, hey, look at this, let's try this. And there has to be some kind of balance between the new and the old. And I think that happened here in Grundy County. Also, Emily and others who were involved, some of the key leaders were deeply rooted and were from there. And then they were also part of groups that had people, what I would say, from off, people who didn't grow up in the county, but who were familiar with it and found a way to be helpful without dictating terms or coming at the issues in a way that threatened people.
Do you plan to follow their progress, Tim?
Well, inevitably, I've got to. I mean, I was somewhat staggered by the amount of activity going on there. And I think it definitely bears looking at again, not just to see where they are in the health rankings. You know, you don't come from last to much above that quickly. What I'm interested in is, you know, there's a parenting class. How does that take off and does it continue? They're putting in a community services center where there was an old high school, you know, kind of a venerable community building. And how does that work and is it successful? And what does the community foundation continue to add assets? Does it find new ways to help the community? They're doing a VISTA program. Do any of these VISTA leaders move back to the community or stick around? Does the university find a way to stay involved, or do they move on to the next shiny project in the future? You know, those are the kinds of questions that I'm interested in and hope I get a chance to follow up on.
Tim Arima talking with us from Knoxville, Tennessee, where he is editor of the Daily Yonder. You'll find it online at Daily Yonder, one word, dailyyonder.com. Thanks a lot, Tim.
You're welcome. Thank you, Tom.
Coming up after the break.
Hello, how can I help you?
Hi, I'm calling to book a woman's haircut for a client. I'm looking for something on May 3rd.
Sure, give me 1 second.
Mm-hmm.
Why are these people laughing? Stick with us and find out. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.fm or the WEKU mobile app. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
It's hard to escape Google these days. It's everywhere, providing all sorts of services as it constantly gathers data on all of its users. Here's a partial list of the available Google products: an internet search engine, email, a news aggregator, calendar software, cloud storage for consumers, cloud storage for businesses, cloud computing for businesses, high-speed internet, laptop computers, desktop computers, computers you wear like glasses, a website for watching internet videos, a web browser, a smartphone tablet or operating system, a thermostat, a home video monitoring system, a collection of photographs of every street in the world, a social network, software for creating and maintaining blogs, an online video rental store, an online software store, a live updating database for equities and financial news, a service that allows you to pay for things with your phone, a language translation service, a video conferencing software. It goes on and on. I haven't read the entire list because I want to make sure I leave some time here to talk with somebody who makes a living helping business executives reach customers via Google's products and services. Joining us is Scott Clark, co-owner of Lexington-based BuzzMaven, Inc., a Google Premier partner, and we thank you for stopping by Eastern Standard, Scott.
Oh, glad to be here, Tom.
So we have a lot of ground to cover here. And first, Google and Facebook are all about gathering data on users. What is clicked on, how fast a person scrolls past a post, what video a person stops to watch. The information helps a company like Google infer characteristics about interests, personal connections, and financial demographics to better target advertising or train machine learning algorithms that can be used for future products. And it's being argued that these companies are so dominant in their core businesses that consumers, if we want to search the internet or be on social media, have no choice but to share our personal data. Do you think it's important, Scott, to fully recognize all of this when we're engaging these products?
Oh, I believe that having some level of awareness of what's being gathered and the benefits of that, and also some of the risks of that. There is a shift now towards empowering the consumer more. We can talk about a bit, but in providing you with a custom experience on the web with relevant advertising and content, Google does, and all the social networks also gather content about your behavior.
Okay, I'd like to run through yet another list of Google products, a short list, if you will, that that you work with or see on the horizon, and get your thoughts on each of them. And the first one is Google Assistant. Tell us about that.
Well, Google Assistant is actually a technology platform that Google developed that is useful on a wide range of devices. Most people know it as something they use on their phone or a smart speaker that you see in advertising, but it's actually possible to use the Google Assistant in cars or motorcycles, on your bike, on your watch. And what it does is it provides a verbal Q&A sort of conversational query mechanism for you to ask questions that Google then answers from its search index. And as of now, most people use it for simple things like weather and hours of operation and traffic reports and things. But it is expanding beyond that as people become more comfortable with it.
So is this Google's version of Siri, the iPhone?
Yes, they fill a very similar role, and I think Google's ambitions are a little broader than Siri ultimately, but they have developed a core technology at Google that is used for the Assistant and many other products.
Now, here's one that we have an audio clip for, and I'm going to play that, and then after we listen to it, I'd like to get your explanation of what this is. And what I'm talking about is Google Duplex. Listen to this.
What you're going to hear is the Google Assistant actually calling a real salon to schedule the appointment for you. Let's listen.
Hello, how can I help you?
Hi, I'm calling to book a woman's haircut for a client. I'm looking for something on May 3rd.
Sure, give me 1 second.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, what time are you looking for around?
At 12 p.m.
We do not have a 12 p.m. available. The closest we have to that is a 1:15.
Do you have anything between 10 a.m. and 12 p.m.?
Depending on what service she would like, what service is she looking for?
Just a woman's haircut for now.
Okay, we have a 10 o'clock.
10 a.m. is fine.
Okay, what's her first name?
The first name is Lisa.
Okay, perfect. So I will see Lisa at 10 o'clock on May 3rd.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Great. Have a great day. Bye.
That was a real call you just heard. The amazing thing is the assistant can actually understand the nuances of conversation.
Okay, Scott, we just heard a conversation. It sounded pretty real.
It does, doesn't it? It's incredible.
Tell us about this.
Well, the Google Duplex is kind of a further evolution of the Google Assistant that is far more conversational, and it has been enabled to do actual human-like conversations without you being present on your behalf. So as you heard in this example, it can call up a service provider like a restaurant or a hair salon and make reservations based on data it has available to you. Then the person that's receiving that call may or may not know that it's an artificial intelligence that's making that call. But it is so good at conversation that you can have a hard time determining that it's actually Google calling, which means that it almost passes the Turing test of computer understanding. Consumers really love this idea of being able to offload these annoying phone conversations and tasks to the system.
I'm sure that this has been in development for quite some time, and people like me, we're just now hearing about it. So for the consumer consciousness, it's just emerging in 2019. The way things rapidly evolve these days in technology, I can foresee that in 2025, we're going to look back on what we just listened to as pretty rudimentary.
Yes.
The implications are kind of awesome.
Yes, and it's all the underpinnings of this mechanism is done with something called a neural network. And a neural network enables us to leverage all the new computing power to teach computer systems much more quickly how to do all kinds of things, including conversations.
And so, speaking of things that Google has in development, closed captioning, what's that about?
Yeah, Google has recently released and developed something called the Live Transcribe tool. It uses something Google's developed called the Cloud Speech API, which is in 70 languages. And it's basically the best ever translation tool that allows you to get textual representation of things that are being said in real time. And the technology has been redeveloped so that most of the processing occurs on the device, like on your phone. So there's not a lot of back and forth happening to Google. So we have very low latency, very high speed performance. And it also gets better every single day as a result of the machine learning that Google's providing to it. The capabilities that it offers include helping people with hearing impairments. You can simply hold up the device for now, like in front of you on the phone, and hear exactly what people are saying in very, very good accuracy and real time. But I believe that'll be an eyeglasses technology within 3 to 5 years. And if you imagine someone that is deaf or has very poor hearing, being suddenly able to participate in conversations in a really fluid, natural way, that's pretty exciting.
Yeah, talk about empowering. That would be one of those examples, wouldn't it? Okay, so next on my list is translation technology. What is that?
Well, there have been some huge advances in language translation at Google since around 2016. And Google has developed through neural networks and machine learning mechanisms for translating languages without first translating them to English. So it's a direct, they call it a direct translation. So you can go from Japanese to Taiwanese directly without having to go through an intermediate step. They've also developed these neural networks to be so compact that they can download the technology necessary to the device itself. So your translations actually don't have to go over the internet. If you turn off your, or if your cell phone is on airplane mode, you can still use the system. And it also means that we can use it on smaller and smaller devices, such as those you might actually be able to just wear like a hearing aid and get real-time translation when you're traveling, for example. It's tied directly to the Google Assistant and the Duplex technologies in the back end. And it starts out and people are contributing the different samples of language to it, different nuances of different languages to it, and it just gets better. Like every time you charge the phone at night, it downloads a new model for you.
Wow.
Yeah, so tomorrow it's a little bit better than today.
Amazing. Okay. Queryless search. That almost sounds like a contradiction. What is that?
Well, when we search the internet, we're actually going on a little journey. And most of the time, we'll do multiple searches when we're looking for something. And that's known as query refinement. It actually is kind of a hassle. It takes time. We didn't get what we wanted the first time. And as a matter of fact, you know, a lot of us have very common patterns when we're searching the internet. So Google can use the patterns that come from the billions of searches that are being done to predict what the next query is that we're going to ask in our sequence and to provide content in anticipation of what we might be searching for next. They've called this feature a discovery, Google Discover, and it goes from, in Google Images, it's pretty powerful to see, how good it is at anticipating what you really wanted. Google uses context of where you are to where you might want to be, and you can see it now using the People Also Ask tool that appears in a lot of Google search results. And that's just moving towards what people ask next in a way. And that's queryless search means you didn't have to explicitly tell Google what you wanted. It anticipated it for you.
Seems safe to say that Google is gathering data from all of us to make all these devices work. And there is increasing consumer awareness that personal data is being mined. What are they doing to make sure that our privacy is protected?
Well, Google understands that they won't be able to continue developing all of this machine learning stuff with sort of free reins to use the data however they want. So they have really steered the company towards approaches that anonymize the data and take away that concern in the underlying technology. One of the ways they're doing it is through this thing called federated computing or federated learning. And what that means is they're using mathematical formulas to take away they still use the data, but they use it in aggregate by removing any personal information from that information and then feeding the machine learning sort of a representation of the crowd instead of an individual. So if you asked Google to say, well, who provided this piece of data, they wouldn't be able to, no matter what. And I believe they recognize way in advance that there will be a lot of people asking a lot of questions about all this data gathering. And as Google becomes more and more dependent on it, they're going to have to defend themselves on that front. So federated, one of the beauties of this federated computing system is that it also keeps a lot of the data, the use of these algorithms local on your phone and doesn't send those things to Google. So it'll do a lot of the work that it used to have to send every request out to the internet to Google. It'll do a lot of it locally. And then it also still benefits from all that learning coming back down to the phone when you're charging it, when you're asleep at night. But none of this is giving away your private information. And that is so Google can defend themselves as privacy awareness really starts to grow.
Okay, Scott, I know about enough about all of this to be dangerous, and that can lead to some dumb questions. But here's one. Is there something related to what you just talked about? It's called General Data Protection Regulation, something called GDPR. What is that?
Yeah, the GDPR is a big regulatory move. It's in the European Union, and the basic premise of it is it's shifting the power of data to the consumer. That happens during data collection, data use, record keeping, and then long-term protection of that data. It's kind of a unification of a lot of smaller privacy laws that they had in the EU into one main named thing. And it's not just names and email addresses that you've given, but also things like your IP address and cookies that are stored on your computer. So it's really broad in its definition of what is consumer data. But the whole thing is meant to give consumers the choice about data collection. And many of you have seen the pop-ups that occur that says, you know, do you accept these cookies? And you're able to say yes or no to different kinds of cookies. This is all about the compliance of with GDPR. And furthermore, the companies that are compliant with GDPR have to provide mechanisms for consumers to request information about what do you know about me right now and all kinds of other things. But the fines for those who violate GDPR are pretty severe, up to 4% of global annual revenue. So for a $50 million company, that would be a $2 million fine. So it's pretty serious.
And what about the California Consumer Privacy Act? Why should we care about that here in Kentucky?
Well, just like in the case of the GDPR, the only thing you have to work, you know, if does it apply to a Kentucky company? The answer is yes. If you have anyone from the EU visiting your site for any reason. So they're visiting your site and leaving behind a cookie, and then now you are now responsible. And the California regulation is GDPR-like. It's supposed to go into effect next year. But it does have a little bit of a larger company kind of profile. In other words, they're looking at companies with $50 million in gross revenue and larger, or firms that are processing a lot of computer data, or firms that do the processing of consumer data as their main job. So it's a little bit narrower than the GDPR is much more broad.
You know, it was interesting thinking about this interview before we sat down to talk about these things. And one of the things that struck me is that, yep, the train really has left the station. In your estimation, Scott Clark, are these digital technologies that we're talking about, are they now so pervasively used and in such constant development and evolution that they are now just a permanent feature of human life?
Well, I think they are. And it's going to be up to us to decide, you know, how much of our lives we want to be integrated with that. Many major components of modern life are tied to things like neural networks and AI. Even sometimes we don't even realize it. Like when you get an X-ray analyzed at a major hospital, it's pretty likely that a machine learning algorithm was the first line of defense against there being a problem with that reading. And it's really good in those ways. But there's healthcare, agriculture, climate change, lots of productivity related things where this technology, I think, is making life better for all of us. And our concerns related to privacy and free speech and the concentration of power at Google or within the government are the things that we've got to keep our eyes on in terms of how we're going to regulate or adopt or refuse to adopt pieces of it. But I think it's like a hammer. These technologies are like a hammer. You can build a house for a homeless person with that hammer, or you can hit someone with it. Mm-hmm. And all these technologies are just like that. They're not inherently evil in any way, and there are some pretty amazing things that can happen from them.
We just have a few seconds left, Scott, and I know that you built a page that our listeners can go to actually further research what we've been talking about. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I thought it might be useful to put some of these things in one place, and so I created a page that covers these things, and you'll find it at buzzmaven.com/whatsnext. And you can I'll be updating that with any links related to this technology and links to some really excellent videos that help people who want to learn a little bit more.
Okay, Scott, really interesting stuff. Scott Clark, co-owner of Lexington-based Buzz Maven, Inc., we thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
You're wondering who I am.
Secret, I've got a secret.
Machine or mannequin.
Secret, I've got a secret.
With parts made.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced in Lexington at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on esweku.com, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu or call and leave voicemail at 859-622-WEKU. That's 622-9358. We might include your thoughts in a forthcoming edition if you tell us we can. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.